I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. Tracy Schultz is my engineer. Tracy, how are you doing today?
Doing well, thank you.
You hanging in there?
Yeah, it's a nice day today.
It's nice. It's not exactly, it doesn't exactly seem like fall, but, you know, it's coming. It's on its way. It's here, but officially. Roger Baker is here taking pictures, and my guest is Michael Hurd, and we'll talk more. This is going to be a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun before the show. I want to remind everybody that Rag Radio is a syndicated radio show, which originates in the studios of KOOP 91.7 FM in Austin, Texas. Co-op is a cooperatively run, all-volunteer community radio station. It's unique in the country, I think, in lots of ways. And there aren't a lot of cooperatively run radio stations around. We are also rebroadcast on several other radio stations. We are streamed live, and our shows are put up as podcasts at the Internet Archive, and also we're run as a feature podcast at the Veterans Today website. So mm-hmm. We're all over the place. We got folks listening to us everywhere, and we have a lot of fun. We're affiliated with the Rag Blog, which is theragblog.com, and the New Journalism Project. So, all right. Ready to go. Journalist, author, historian Michael Hurd is my guest, and we're going to be talking about preserving Black history and culture in Texas. Michael, welcome to Rag Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Thorne.
Okay. Michael Hurd is an author, journalist, historian, was born in Texarkana, Texas, and grew up in Houston. He is managing editor of the Texas Black History Preservation Project, which is documenting the almost 500-year history of African Americans in Texas as an online encyclopedia. And he is the director of the Texas Institute for the Preservation of History and Culture at Prairie View A&M University, the school's Black History Center. Hurd is currently working with the University of Texas Press on a book about the storied history of football programs at Texas's all-Black high schools, pre-integration, the Prairie View Interscholastic League. Hurd was a sports writer for the Houston Post, where his primary beat was covering small college sports, and the Austin American Statesman, where he was also an assistant city editor. For 11 years, he worked as a sports writer for USA Today, beginning in 1982 as a member of the newspaper's founding staff. And he worked as an editorial producer at Yahoo Sports. As a journalist, Hurd has also chronicled events such as the Million Man March and has written in-depth stories on social issues such as affirmative action and the academic performances and graduation rates of Black athletes at major universities. Okay.
That's a lot.
And that's not all.
There's so much more.
It's too much. Too much for all of us. It's just crazy. Yeah. I there's just a whole lot to talk about. I mean, I love sitting around talking about old newspaper days, and which is some of what we talked about before the show. But here's what I want to ask you first, and we'll talk about basically two projects that you're okay. working with. I know you're in the process of packing up and moving to Houston, and I guess you're going to actually be working out of Prairie View?
Yes, exactly. I'll be at Prairie View for now. I'm there a couple of days a week at their Black History Center, the Texas Institute for the Preservation of History and Culture. A lot of good work to be done there, Thorne, in regard to Black history in Texas. And I am excited about taking this position.
Well, it's great, and you're going to continue being involved in the other project too.
Yes, in fact, one of my major tasks is to combine the work that I've been doing for the TBHPP with the work that's being done for TIPHC. And I started the Texas Black History Preservation Project in 2007 with my good friend from the Statesman, Roxanne Evans. So we co-founded the organization, back then, and we had been working towards getting a relationship with the university for our research and so forth. And Prairie View stepped up a few months ago and was very excited about what we'd been doing, and wanted to bring us aboard
are you looking to actually combine the two projects?
I'm combining the two projects, partnering, coordinating our efforts. So It hasn't reflected in our websites yet, but I'll be announcing that on our website.
Cool.
That we will be an official partner with Prairie View. So it'll end up being something like TBHPP at Prairie View or TBHPP at TIPHC at Prairie View. You know, so.
No,
but yeah.
No, Sanders, help.
We're in acronym hell. But, it'll be, I'll be working. For TBHPP and at Prairie View.
Okay, all right.
Combining the efforts.
Yeah, I would say okay, got all that, but you know, I'd be lying. No, I understand.
Sure.
Okay, before we go talk any more about those projects, I want to talk about. I mean, there's just a whole lot to talk about African American history in this state.
Mm-hmm.
But tell us. I'm always interested in people's. You know, life and professional trajectories.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us how football got you into being interested in Black history.
Well, back in the Stone Age, when I was in high school in the 60s, Black history wasn't really taught. And what we got in high school back then was that there was slavery. There was the Civil War, which, believe it or not, there really was a connection.
Right.
They're not teaching that now. But there was slavery, the Civil War, and then Lincoln freed the slaves, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And that's all we got, you know, back then. There was no context or any depth to it at all. So I didn't really have an in-depth knowledge about Black history at all. So... when I started my my career as a sports writer at the Post and started covering small colleges, which primarily meant Texas Southern University, a historically Black college in Houston, and looking at their history. And in the process of doing that, I had looked around and started asking people, has anybody ever done a history about Black college football? And sure enough, nobody really had. There had been a few articles here and there, but no one had really done a comprehensive history about these programs at historically Black colleges that ranged from Morgan State University in Baltimore to Prairie View in Texas. And, of course, basically those schools are located in the South and were created to educate newly freed slaves. So I started doing the history about Black college football. But in the course of doing that history, one of the methods that I used was looking at Black newspapers on microfilm with the intent of looking at those newspapers and studying their sports pages to see what they had written about Black colleges, because mainstream newspapers weren't writing about Black college sports. Even a great program like Grambling and A.J. Robinson in Louisiana did not have a white...
Who's one of the great football coaches of all time anywhere.
Exactly, yeah. And retired as the winningest coach in college football of all times. But even Grambling, as great as that program was, never had a white reporter on campus until the late 60s. So they weren't really covering that. So I'm looking at all of this history, and I'm looking at these old newspapers. And I said, okay, I just want to look at the sports page. And so I would pull up the paper, I would look at the front page, and I would be just stuck. It's like, I can't just flip through this.
Yeah.
And I started reading about all of these things. And I love those papers. I love the writing. I love the way they were presented. I love the images, everything. And they covered everything about the Black community. And so I started reading all of these Black newspapers, and I would finally get to the sports pages, but what I read before then is what really started to pull me in. And I started to see all of these facts, because a lot of those papers would have a little item today in Black history or this fact about Black history. And I kept having these, why don't I know that moment? You know, all of these things that I never knew, I'd never heard of. And now all of a sudden, I'm learning all of these things about Black history. And one of the things that I started reading about that kept coming up in my research was an event called the Houston Riots in 1917 in Houston, or the Camp Logan Mutiny. Right. And I kept coming across that. I grew up in Houston. I had never heard of the Houston Riots. I had no idea what that was about. And that just further piqued my curiosity and my desire to learn more about Black history. And so in the process of researching Black college football, I started to veer off into Black history in general. And that's where I really got started with researching Black history, and then specifically into Texas Black history.
Well, and if you're going to tell the story of Black history in Texas, you're going to be talking a lot about football. Right?
Exactly.
I mean, it played a very, very important role, high school and the historically Black colleges.
Exactly. Black college football in Texas specifically, but Black college football in general, has produced so many incredible athletes that nobody knew about when they were in college, because the Houston Post, the Houston Chronicle would write a few things, but not a lot in terms of feature stories or daily coverage about those schools. And of course, throughout the South, none of those schools really got any coverage from their daily newspapers. But you're talking about just from Texas alone, you have people like Ernie Ladd, who came out of Orange, Texas, Kenny Houston, who came out of Lufkin, people like that, and just an incredible amount of wonderful athletes. And my latest project is about the Prairie View Interscholastic League, the all-Black high schools in Texas before integration. So I'm researching and writing a book about that experience for the University of Texas Press, and hopefully we'll have that out by next year. But I'm a product of the Prairie View Interscholastic League. Houston Worthing High School, which produced one of the great wide receivers in the NFL, Clifford Branch, who was a classmate of mine. So I'm talking about that experience.
Did you play?
I was a late bloomer athletically in high school. I was a journal. I wrote. I loved to write. Worked for the school paper. So I did not play sports in high school, but discovered what athleticism I did have while I was in the Air Force for 8.5 years, and I played football and ran track and played baseball and mostly basketball. So I discovered myself as an athlete in the Air Force, and actually came out of the Air Force in 1976 to be a walk-on in basketball at the University of Texas. And that wow. did not go well. I had torn my Achilles 6 months before I got out of the Air Force. So by the time I got down here, I met Abe Lemons, who was the coach at the time, and he could not have been better, nicer to me. He just said, just come out, show me you can play, and everything's fine. Well, I could barely walk, let alone run and make a jump shot. So I didn't make that team. But a quick Abe Lemons story. I was working for the Daily Texan at the time, and I wrote a column about it, how I had come here to walk on, and I had failed miserably, and just ran to the journalism department and started, you know, working as a sports writer, and I wrote that column. And I talked to Abe several years later, and he said, well, you know, I like that column you wrote. He said, in fact, I carried that around. For I carried that around for the longest time. I said, I think I lost it, though. I said, well, Abe, I think I have a copy. Would you want me to get you a copy? And he said, yeah, but don't quit your day job looking for it. But that was my experience. Yeah.
In researching that book,
yes.
What are some of the things that you've found out, that you've run across? I mean, how do you go about researching it in some of the same ways? I mean,
The high school book?
Yeah. The one you're working on right now, yeah.
Yeah, the one I'm working on right now.
And why? And then I want you to tell us why that league was so significant. You know.
Well, we're talking about a time, the segregationist era in Texas. And when the UIL was formed in 1910 at the university, their charter specifically said their membership was only available to white schools. So they had nothing to do with the Black schools. 10 years later, in 1920, a couple of professors, some officials at Prairie View, got together and said, you know, we'd like to have our league. You know, we'd like to do something for Black kids, too. So the PVIL was started in 1920 as a MIRA organization for the UIL, governing academic, athletic, music, band competitions for the black high schools in Texas, which peaked in number at 500. So at one time there were as many as 500 black high schools and all black high schools in Texas. And generally in most areas, you would have a white school and a black school. And of course they were totally different and had nothing to do with each other. But coming out of those, coming out of that era, the players who played at some of those schools were just incredible. You know, again, I mentioned Cliff Branch and Kenny Houston out of Lufkin Dunbar, but you talk Abner Haynes out of Dallas Lincoln, Dwayne Thomas, who came out of Dallas, and players like that. They were just some incredible players. And it's a similar story to black college football, because you're talking about some programs that mainstream people really didn't talk about or know about. In fact, when I wrote the book about black college football and talked to some of those guys, they would refer to themselves as SBCs, as in small black college, because when they started getting exposure in the American Football League back in the day, which was really huge for black college football, the announcers had no idea where any of these people had gone to school. You know, they might say, well, Joe Namath, and they would be a Bear Bryant, Alabama, great program, but they might see somebody like a Kenny Houston and says from a small black college in Texas called Prairie View. Or, you know, Claude Humphrey out of Tennessee State, you know, a small black college in Nashville,
right.
You know, Tennessee State, that sort of thing. So, but it's even less for the black high schools in Texas, because there were so many people, you know, like I said, those communities were divided, you know, blacks on one side and whites on the other, different schools, that sort of thing. Or if you lived in a town that didn't have a black high school, you were bused to the nearest black high school, whatever was in your area, you know. So I started researching that, because again, I'm a product of the PVIL, and it's just kind of piqued my interest in what that league was all about and what their history was all about.
Well, it's interesting. Everybody now, if they weren't before, is aware of the incredible importance that high school football has in this state.
Mm-hmm.
Friday Night Lights, you know, brought that to people who weren't already aware of it. Anybody who's involved in any kind of professional sports, and especially who does any scouting or recruiting, you know, has certainly known for a long time about it.
Exactly. I'm sorry to interrupt, but
no.
I the first time that I heard the term Friday Night Lights, I don't remember when the first time I did hear about it, but the first time I heard that term, I had no idea what that meant.
Right, right.
Because it didn't mean a thing to us in Houston, where I grew up, because the schools in the black schools in Houston played on Wednesday nights and Thursday nights.
So it was Wednesday and Thursday nights.
And I was talking to a guy who had played at one of the schools recently in Houston, and he said to me, "I didn't even know they used that stadium on Friday nights." I mean, that's how insane it was—the segregation and the separatism.
Well, when we talk about the incredible importance that high school football has had in the state, I assume that it was just as significant in the black community,
of course,
or more so, maybe even.
Exactly. Pretty much the same importance, the same enthusiasm, you know, for football. Just that. People in general really didn't gravitate towards that, though. In some of those towns, I've talked to some of the players, and they would say that sometimes they would have more white people in the stands than black people. So they knew about it, but it was just this one little, I guess, moment in time where, you know, there would be this kind of integration, though the stands would be segregated. You know, they wouldn't
right.
be sitting together.
Right.
Sometimes they would, but generally they wouldn't be sitting together.
Right.
But, you know, so some of the smaller towns, they would actually go to the black high school games and cheer for those teams.
Okay. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. My guest is journalist, author and historian Michael Hurd. We'll be right back, and we won't talk more football. We're going to go into some other stuff, although we're having a lot of fun talking football. Maybe we'll just do that the whole show.
No, all right, that's fine with me.
Okay, Tracy, take it away. Some things will never change. We're back with Michael Hurd here. Tracy Schultz first. What were we just listening to?
We had Bruce Hornsby coming back there. It's like with Just the Way It Is. And second, right before that, we had Stevie Wonder with Black Man. That's both of those suggested by our guest today. It's like good choices, man.
Okay. Well, he suggested a lot of stuff, and we were actually thinking about just listening to music.
We had a lot to choose from. Yeah.
It's a good time. Cool stuff. So. Okay. Michael Hurd is... A journalist, historian, author, is managing editor of the Texas Black History Preservation Project and is director of the Texas Institute for the Preservation of History and Culture at Prairie View A&M, and those will eventually probably be one entity.
Exactly, yes.
One entity with many tentacles. Okay. Obviously, if we talk about Texas history, slavery is certain. You had, I noticed on the site, you had one of the people that you talked about on the great site. People should go to the Texas history site.
Yes, the address is tbhpp.org. tbhpp.org.
You talked about Esteban.
Yes.
Slave, conquistador, and the first African in Texas. Tell us.
One of my favorite stories in history, and I think one of the most exciting stories in all of history. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Esteban was a Moor, and he came over with several Spanish conquistadors, including Cabeza de Vaca, and they had this. Their journey was across the Atlantic to explore the Florida coast, and then into the Gulf. And in the process of doing that, they encountered these fierce storms. And there were several ships that started out, but only as a result of these storms, they had these ships were wrecked. But on the morning of November 28th, Esteban and the surviving conquistadors waded ashore at what is now Galveston, near what is now Galveston. And this was 1728. So they begin this journey from that island off the Gulf, and they walked. They walked for 8 years through Texas into West Texas, and then south across the Rio Grande, down into Mexico to Culiacan, and finally to Mexico City. And in the course of their journeys, Esteban, who they talk about as being a slave, really is kind of the leader of that expedition. The Native Americans who they encountered considered him as some kind of a shaman, a healer. And he had these communicative skills where he would go and he would talk with the natives that they encountered and somehow either earn their favor or the natives would, you know, help them along their way. So, but in the process of that journey, I can't imagine what that must have been like. They were literally naked for most of that journey, barefoot and walking. You know, today it's tough for people to walk across the street. You know, and these guys walk through this rugged terrain and jungles and desert and so forth for 8.5 years, and they survived it. Four guys, Esteban and Cabeza de Vaca, Cervantes, and I'm blanking on the other guy, Castillo, survived that walk. But I think that's just an amazing story of courage and survival.
Yeah, really. Are there lots? I guess there are just lots of stories.
Yeah, and again, Esteban is noted as the first black African in the state of Texas.
Right, right. I picked up something from there's a website called Color of Change, mm-hmm. Which does some pretty great work, and they're talking about textbooks. Mm-hmm. And textbooks, especially dealing with black history and systemic racism. Textbooks, you know, how we tell history, how we record history, mm-hmm. Not just black history, mm-hmm. period. Mm-hmm. History is always told by the conquerors, for instance. You know, it's obviously told from a class perspective.
Exactly.
It's told from a race perspective. Mm-hmm. How does that, I mean, how does it get distorted? How does black history get distorted in the textbooks? Well, that's question one. So.
Yeah, well, you know, as you mentioned,
not just the textbooks, but the textbooks are a critical factor.
But as you mentioned, Thorne, a lot of black history, history in general, you know, depends on who's telling that story. Mm-hmm. And so often in terms of black history, you know, we haven't told our own story. So more black scholarship is available now, and you're getting that perspective, you know, on black history. But what's happened recently with the state school board and the movement to revise history, and it's really sad what those textbooks will be teaching the kids in Texas about history. You know, this whole notion that the Civil War and slavery were not connected is incredibly insane because they were.
No, it was just about preserving a culture, dude.
Well, no. And it was about preserving a culture, yeah, and the culture, that was being preserved was segregationist and racist, and that's the culture that's being preserved. But the revisionist history that's being put into textbooks now, like I said, it's just outrageous because it's not right, and for kids to grow up thinking that there were no connections between Civil War and slavery, or knowing the true understanding of what slavery was about and what that war was about, it's just very sad. So that's one of the things that we're doing with the Texas Black History Preservation Project and the TIPHC at Prairie View, is trying to get more of those stories out there and try to enlighten not only the community in general, but specifically to young African Americans who are coming up and really don't know that history, because it's not really being taught in schools. It's not really being taught well, and there's such a de-emphasis on ethnic studies, black history, Latino history, Asian history, the whole thing. So our project and our charge is to get more of those stories out there. And we've already been hearing in regard to what we're doing with TBHPP in our online encyclopedia, we're hearing from a lot of teachers and just people in the communities in general who are thanking us and are really glad to see that we're doing what we're doing and getting those stories out there to be
what
told.
What an important task. What an important job to do. So, you know, incidentally, in terms of revisionist history, there's a lot of revisionism going on with the story of the Vietnam War.
Exactly.
You know, which is just bizarre, you know, some of the things that are happening. You talked about the African diaspora to the Americas. What that obviously defines much of, I mean, it's a defining factor in all of Black history. It has to be.
Well, you know, one of the things that, well, this whole project, the TBHPP, has been enlightening to me. You know, I have learned so much, and I've become such a library geek, and I'm really happy about that, and I'm proud of that. But being from a family of teachers, you know, my mom taught, her sister and brothers, they all taught. They all went to Black colleges, by the way. So I grew up reading a lot. We always had a lot of books around, but again, not knowing a lot about Black history. And one of the things, this might be my favorite aspect of what I've learned about Texas Black history, is that so many Africans who first came to this part of the world came through Mexico, through Veracruz. You know, and at one point, there were more Africans in Mexico, which was back then known as New Spain. There were more Africans in New Spain than there were Spaniards for several years, for quite a while, because the Spaniards would bring these boatloads of slaves from Africa to work in the silver mines, in the gold mines, to work in the fields, to be servants and slaves in Mexico. And they far outnumbered Spaniards for quite a while. And you still have several communities in Mexico near Veracruz, near Costa Chica in western Mexico, where you still have Afro-Mexican communities. And in fact, we have a professor at San Diego State, Anthony Jerry, who does research on those communities, and he will be writing, he and his students are going to be writing something for us talking about those Afro-Mexican communities and today and how they have survived and thrived. But that's how so many of the Africans who first came to this part of the world arrived, got to Texas. After being slaves in Mexico, they freed themselves, running away. You may know of the person called Gaspar Yanga. Yanga was this leader. He was a leader and established what they call Maroons. They were runaways, and they established these all-Black communities. And we think some of those people just migrated further north across the Rio Grande and became some of the first Blacks in Texas.
A fascinating thing is the nature of Black communities in Texas, you know, and the culture of those communities and how that culture really, you know, was not known and did not have influence other places. It did and ultimately have lots of influence. But exactly. The way those towns were organized, the way the freed slave communities were organized, all of that stuff is fascinating.
Yeah, you know, it is. And Texas... Yeah, well, there's one thing about the Civil War. There were no real major battles in Texas about the Civil War, so there was not a major presence for the Union Army in Texas. And so, in that regard, when you start to talk about Juneteenth and why it took so long for word to get to Texas, was because in the states where the battles were raging, you know, further south. If there was a Union presence, they would free the slaves, or, you know, word would get out that later that the Emancipation Proclamation had been passed, and they would go in and they could free slaves. But you didn't really have that in Texas so much. So the slavery in Texas kind of endured a little bit longer, you know. And there are stories about why it took so long, 2.5 years, after Lincoln issues the Emancipation Proclamation, why it took so long for that word to get to Texas. Well, there are all these different stories and myths and lies and that sort of thing. One story was that there was a messenger that was a Union soldier was supposed to come to Texas and deliver the word, and then he got killed and never got here. I don't know about that part. But a more popular story is that the farmers in Texas, the cotton planters, wanted to get one more crop, you know, out of their slaves before they gave them word
one
of the
more season, please.
One more season, you know, and that kind of makes a lot more sense to me. And
for people who don't know, incidentally, and a lot of people outside of Texas don't know what Juneteenth is, but that's when it was observed, because that's when it observes the time when. Correct me if I'm wrong. When people actually
Gordon Granger arrives in Galveston and makes the announcement, gives General Order Number 3, as it was called, announcing that slaves in Texas were free, and it just set off this kind of pandemonium. You know, the black people were very happy. White people thought it was the beginning of the apocalypse, and you know, they were going to have all these free black people running around, and so everybody was freaking out about that. But yeah, Juneteenth is the day when the word finally came that slaves in Texas were free.
All right, Michael Hurd is my guest on Rag Radio, and we'll be back after this.
In a little tent, oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too. But I'm afraid to die, 'cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. Tracy, what are we listening to there?
Had a little bit of a Booker T, and then right before that, classic Sam Cooke, A Change Gonna Come. It was like recommended by our guest.
Okay, all right. Our guest is Michael Hurd, and we're talking about preserving black history and culture in Texas. One thing to tie it into what we were just talking about, were you involved at all in the... controversy and the larger issue is the question of Confederate symbols, you know, and which has become a major issue. And of course, at the University of Texas, there was the whole issue around the statues, which resulted in they were moving, or have moved,
I guess.
Robert E. Lee,
yes.
Poor baby, he's going to the Dolph Briscoe Center for,
yes.
I think. Were you involved in that?
We have written about it, posted stories about it on our website and in our newsletter talking about it. And again, I think we were talking about before, you know, people talk about preserving a culture and a heritage, but the heritage that those folks are looking to preserve is racist, you know, and divisive, and just really we need to move beyond that. You know, and actually I have people who say to me, well, talking about Black history is divisive. But, you know, if you're telling stories that are truthful and honest and real, then I don't see the divisiveness in that beyond personal people having their feelings hurt because the truth is being told.
What do you say to people who I just think this is a bizarre claim, but who say that doing things like removing Confederate statues and it is rewriting history, that it's being like the Taliban or ISIS or something, or malice, you know, where statues are, where, I mean, it seems like symbols have meaning, and
well,
for some
do.
People, they mean they're hate. They're symbols of hate.
And they're symbols of hate, Thorne. And
nobody's changing history.
And I am not saying do away with that flag. I'm not saying do away with those statues or
hang
any
it
of
somewhere.
Those or any of those mementos or that are, you know, relative to that. But
put them in
they
the
have
real historical
place,
context, right?
But I don't think they have a place where they're being celebrated in public, you know, as a good thing. You have to remember that history, certainly, but I think you put those symbols in a place. They belong in museums.
Right.
They belong in a separate place where, because they're part of the story, and you have to tell that story, but you have to tell that story with some context. And when you look at the statues on the state capitol lawn and some of these other places, and the inscriptions underneath, they don't really give context to what was really going on and why we're really remembering those people.
Right, right. There, I know there's other stories in other areas that you'd like to touch on, and you know those better than I do. What are some things that you think are important that will be revealing to our listeners?
Well, I am really excited about this book that I'm doing on the PVIL.
Which is, tell people again, for anybody who just...
It's the Prairie View Interscholastic League, and it was the mirror organization to the University Interscholastic League. UIL was for white schools, the PVIL was for Black schools. But and this is also me discovering my history again, you know, which is the best thing, I think, about studying history in general. You learn about yourself. You learn about who you are. And doing the research on this book, I'm learning so much about who I am and where I came from. And again, being a product of the PVIL, I went to high school in Houston, Ebony Worthing High School in Sunnyside, South Houston. And I graduated in 1967, in June of 1967. In the fall of 1967 was the first season that Black schools and white schools competed against each other. And so I had gone to all segregated schools growing up, all Black schools growing up. And I graduated
that. I went to all white schools growing
okay.
up.
Okay, we had talked about, yeah.
Yeah.
So I go back to homecoming in the fall, and it's totally different. You know, so
really.
You know, I'd gone to all Black schools.
Things
and
really
go back
have
in the
changed
fall,
a lot.
And in the course of 3 months, everything had just totally changed. But, you know, just talking about that PVIL history, and the PVIL produced one of the first Black quarterbacks in the NFL, a guy named Charlie Choo Choo Brackens, who played at Prairie View and was an incredible passer, was drafted by the Green Bay Packers and got to play a couple of minutes in a game for Green Bay, but then, of course, didn't last given the tenor of the times back then. But there are five players from the PVIL who are in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Kenny Houston, Joe Green, Charlie Taylor, and I'm going to forget the other two. But but there are five players. Gene Upshaw is one, though. Gene Upshaw went to a school called Robstown near Corpus Christi, and it really wasn't a PVIL school, but the PVIL kind of claims it. But yeah, so the PVIL has this great history, and I'm really excited about the opportunity to record and document it.
We should mention to people, by the way, it's not something I mentioned in the introduction, is mm-hmm. that Michael Hurd serves on the, and I guess this is still true, the selection committee for the Black College Football Hall of Fame.
Yes, I do.
And was a member of the group that put together an exhibit on Black college football for the new college Football Hall of Fame
in
building
Atlanta.
In Atlanta, mm-hmm. And in October 2013 was a featured panelist for a program at the National Archives in mm-hmm. Washington, D.C., titled Breaking the Line, Black College Football and the Civil Rights Movement.
Yes. I really enjoyed being on that panel with my good friend Sam Friedman from the New York Times, and we also had James Harris, the great quarterback from Grambling, you know, talking about that era, and how Black college football collided literally with the civil rights movement, and some of the players who and how they dealt with that, because some of those guys had to make choices. You know, I want to play football, and of course their coach is like, yeah, you can play football, but we don't want you out in the streets demonstrating, you know, and doing those kinds of things. But Deacon Jones, the great Rams defensive end, really collided with the civil rights movement. He started out at South Carolina State in Orangeburg, and apparently Deacon was quite vocal. He was then, and he is now, about civil rights. And the sheriff in Orangeburg politely asked Deacon Jones to leave town.
Really?
And so Deacon Jones literally gets run out of town in Orangeburg because of his civil rights activities. But he transfers to Mississippi Vocational in Itobina, Mississippi, which is now Mississippi Valley State. Which, of course, produced the great Jerry Rice.
Wow. I guess, but when you say they collided, I guess mm-hmm. The civil rights movement was threatening to a lot of people, not just to white people.
Huh?
There was institutional stuff that was built up over generations.
Certainly, and you had a lot of people. You know, I say a lot, and I know a lot of people agree with me because I've had this conversation a lot, that integration was a good thing and it was a bad thing. Good in general because of the opportunities that we were given as part of the Black community, the opportunities that we were given and the doors that opened up for us and the things that we could do. But it was a bad thing in the sense that so much of the Black community's identities were taken away. Again, in a football sense, at one point, you know, you had people like the Black college, you had somebody, say like an Earl Campbell, you know, of course with University of Texas, you know, back in the day, somebody like Earl Campbell almost automatically would have gone to a Black college, you know, because he wouldn't have been able to get into the big schools. So the Black colleges and Black communities took a big hit with integration because we didn't have the best and the brightest automatically serving in the Black communities anymore. They were taken away with the opportunities, which, again, they were good, but a lot of what you see in terms of the downfall of Black communities came as a result of integration and the best and the brightest, you know, moving away from those communities and not contributing anymore.
In Austin, there's a couple of Willies. Mm-hmm. Who played pretty important roles. Why don't you, you know, Willie Wells?
Yes,
and
Negro
Leagues. Willie Mae Kirk.
Yeah, oh, Miss Kirk.
Those are the Willies.
Miss Kirk, God rest her soul, one of my all-time favorite people, and, of course, the mother of Ron Kirk, you know, the first Black mayor for Dallas. Miss Kirk
was the brother of Vicki Kirk, mm-hmm. or not Vicki anymore, Anyway, so, yeah.
Miss Kirk was just a wonderful soul,
right.
And of course very active and in the Black community, citywide, and making a lot of things happen in the Austin community.
And Willie Wells, of course, there was a lot of controversy over. I guess they did end up naming something at Barton's, Willie the Hill or something after him, but Willie Wells was a very significant baseball player.
Yeah. And you know, that's, you know, Mr. Wells, in terms of his athletic abilities and accomplishments, and again, going back to the PVIL, Anderson High School, you know, when you look at Anderson High School and the great players who came out of that program, and we're doing a lot with them. One of the things that we're doing with this PVIL book is we're also looking at doing a documentary about the PVIL and looking back and talking about some of all these wonderful players who came out of that era. And a lot of those guys came out of Anderson High School, which, you know, we now call Old Anderson High School. And we have the new Anderson High School over in West Austin. And it was really nice to see this spring that both of those schools came together and kind of acknowledged each other, which is something that hadn't happened before, you know, and introducing old Anderson's history to new Anderson, you know, which had not been done before. So it was really nice to see those schools come together and acknowledge each other and their histories.
Okay, what else? What are some other stories? What are some other tales that you've learned in this work that are especially interesting and significant historically?
Oh, boy, it's just been so much, Thorne, you know, and it's, like I said, for our project.
What else don't we know about Black history? What else is some of the hidden, you know, what are we not, especially in the larger community?
Well, you know, the thing that, I guess the story, and I touched on it briefly, the Houston riots in 1917, which was just a revelation to me. And what happened in that incident was basically the Buffalo Soldiers. They were, you know, 24th Infantry was a division of Buffalo Soldiers. And they were sent to Houston after the outbreak of World War I to guard the construction for a training camp at Camp Logan. They were going to bring in all of these guys to train, National Guard members to train, before they went over to fight in World War I. And Camp Logan was located at what is now Memorial Park in Houston. And they send these guys down. They're basically military policemen. However, they're not allowed to carry weapons because they didn't want to see black men with weapons, you know, in the city. So they came down to guard the construction, but they get verbally and physically abused on a daily basis by Houston's white citizens, and specifically the Houston policemen. And things finally, long story short, things kind of came to a head one night, and the soldiers thought that one of theirs had been killed by a Houston policeman. And there they decided they were going to march on Houston and kill every white policeman they encountered. So they stormed the armory on the post because they weren't able to carry their weapons. So they broke into the armory, they get their weapons, they march on Houston. They never get to the police station, which was their destination to get to the police station. They never get there, but in the course, they end up killing 17 people. And the Houston riots is known as the only riot in U.S. history where more whites were killed than blacks. And the four black men who died were all members of the 24th and died of friendly fire because some of them get into the march and they decide, well, we don't want any of this. We want to go back. We want to go back to the post. So as a result, you have 63 men were tried at Fort Sam Houston, and there was no hard evidence that any of those guys had done anything. 13 of those guys were summarily hung a couple of months later. First thing in the morning with no notice, 13 of those guys hung. And it's one of the saddest stories because if you go to their grave sites at Fort Sam Houston on their headstones, it was basically, you know, most of those headstones had Sergeant, you know, Joe Smith, served, born, died, did this, did that. For those guys, it was basically just their names and their date of birth and the date that they died.
Have you done much research into the Ku Klux Klan and the other kind of paramilitary?
Just as in some of the stories that I tell, how they Not so much, you know, what they're doing and how they were formed and so forth and so on, though you look back at the Fort Pillow incident in Tennessee, where General Nathan Bedford Forrest basically massacred dozens, hundreds of black soldiers. And, of course, he goes on to become the founder of the Ku Klux Klan.
Right. Okay, we're out of time.
I've rattled on it happens, long enough.
It happens so fast. So, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you, guys.
Michael Hurd, thank you for being with us. And we'll do it again sometime.
Let's do.
Okay. Next week, Margaret Randall, who is a wonderful poet and author, the author of a book, Haiti, Santa Maria, Cuban Revolutionary, that Alice Embry reviewed on the Rag Blog very recently. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio.